Welcome back to The Kaufman Show, your favorite show on TSN 690. I'm Dave Kaufman, and tonight I am joined by a special co-host in studio, Mr. Sean Farrell. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Dave. Great to be here.
How are you, man?
Yeah, it's great to see you again.
Always a good time when Sean is in studio. Sean was working here when I first got my start.
That's right. During the lockout, the previous NHL lockout, 2004-2005.
My goodness, it feels like forever ago.
Yeah, it's been a while. And we had a baseball team.
No, we didn't.
Well.
No, we didn't.
You're right, technically.
When I first started here was the winter after the Expos left. And we're going to dial it back even further tonight in a few minutes' time. We're going to talk about believer fever. And, you know, I got to make clear, we're not talking about Justin Bieber. For all of our young listeners, that is not what we're discussing. But there was a phenomenon that started in this city 10 years ago. And really reached its apex 10 years ago this week. It was pretty much downhill from here after August of 2003.
Oh, yeah. What a turn that was to go from the highest highs to the lowest lows.
And that's what it was. That's what it was. And we'll go into it in great detail tonight at 6:30. I think we'll probably start our Expos Love Fest. And we'll hear from Sean. We'll, of course, talk about Sean was writing for the Associated Press at the time and covered the Expos on a very intimate basis. Many game stories, as Sean has been so graciously sharing with me on my Facebook page of late, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I think I had five final Expos seasons covering the Expos for the AP from 1998 to 2004.
And now, of course, you work for Canadian Press. You're on sports at CJAD. Do you know those are four letters I didn't used to be allowed to say sitting in this chair? It's pretty cool.
Part of the family now.
That's right. That's right. And, yeah, of course, you're a freelance writer extraordinaire. You do some news stuff as well. Your coverage of Lac-Mégantic Antique this year was fantastic.
Thank you.
And we'll get your opinion on a few other subjects before we get into the Expo stuff. But we'll also be joined by Max Harris, who is now an employee of the San Francisco Giants, I believe. But Max was, he was a two-time reigning Team 990 trivia champ and a season ticket holder for the Montreal Expos, one of the biggest Expos fans I know. So Max will have a lot of great memories and stories to share. And then we'll close out the show by speaking with Manny Acta, your old Metro buddy.
Subway, yeah, mate. That's right. Yeah, we used to ride the Metro after the games. Jerry Morales, the third base coach. Manny was third.
Exactly. So Manny was the third base coach back then. He then went on to manage the Washington Nationals. He then went on to, bless you, Amanda Stein. He then went on to manage the Cleveland Indians up until the middle of last season. He was, of course, replaced by Terry Francona. Those Indians are on a tear right now, playing very good baseball.
And Manny's a great follow on Twitter.
He is.
In both languages.
That's right. He tweets in Spanish. A lot of Spanish. He's the GM of the Licey Tigers now as well, and an ESPN contributor.
Right.
So it'll be a lot of fun to catch up with Manny. He's also a huge fan of our city, of the culinary pleasures of our city. I guarantee you right now, I will guarantee you he mentioned smoked meat.
Oh, yeah.
While we're on air without any prompting from either of us.
Yeah. Well, he seemed very, very comfortable in Montreal when he was here.
I couple of things I want to get to before we get into our Expos talk. And we'll also speak with Torben Rolfsson in about 15 minutes, our Vancouver-based, Honey Youngman-esque comedian. But this deal was reached today, Sean. I'm not sure if you were paying attention, but between the NFL and the lawsuit, 4,500 former NFLers had sued the NFL, and they reached a deal today.
I saw the headline.
$765 million settlement. An eye-poppingly huge number until you break it down. Comes about, I think at the end, the number is 170, and I don't think that that counts out any legal fees, but let's call it 170. The average player will receive $170,000 for being a part of this suit. Now, there are men, who will receive more if you have ALS or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. It's $5 million. If you're diagnosed with CTE after your death, and frankly, they haven't figured out a way to diagnose you with CTE before your death, it's $4 million. $3 million if you have dementia. I'd like to get your thoughts on this. 514-790-1690. Do you think that this is a fair number? Because I look at it and I think $170,000 is a very low number to put on somebody's future. And just think about the costs. The costs of medical care in the United States. Is it worth your trouble to play professional football? And it's hard as a 20-year-old, you know, with the world in front of you and your eyes all rosy and thinking that this is how you're going to build your career. This is how you're going to make your mark. Is it worth not being able to walk at 35?
And you think
not being able to think at 45?
The
being dead
of
at
the
55?
Careers.
Tiny. 4 years? 3 years? Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Possibly shorter than that. When you spread it through all the positions.
We've got the polemicist ringing in on Twitter. The NFL settlement marks the beginning of the end of youth football in public schools on this continent. I wonder if that's the case.
There are a lot of parents who are concerned about their children making the choice to go play football.
Damn straight. 514-790-1690. If you're out of town, 1-866-896-2546. This is the Kaufman Show on TSN 690. I'm joined by Sean Farrell tonight. You're on Twitter, Sean. It's Sean Farrell 27, right?
That's right.
Just like Alex Kovalev. Look at that. let's go to Mel in St. Laurent. Hello, Mel.
Guys, how you doing, man? You're talking about, you drew me like a fly to you-know-what when you start talking about the Expos. But
you bring up
the issue of all of the horrible, horrible injuries, the results of these sports that are with the high impact, the craziness. You know, I actually started writing an article, a monthly article about sports, and one of the articles I wrote was a column called Turning a Blind Eye, and it was pretty much focusing in on this horrible issue where sports, and I've always been a huge sports fan of the majors, be it football, baseball, hockey, and it just got to a point for me anyways where I had to start turning a blind eye, feeling a bit like a hypocrite, because when you see guys like Junior Seau commit suicide at a young age, when you see a quarterback who was so dynamic, Jim McMahon, who his brain has turned into mush, who gets lost just going to get a bottle of milk around the corner. It's a horrible price to pay. And you ask, is this a fair amount? There is no amount of money that can replace what these guys have lost and given up. And the hypocrisy that is so prevalent among the major leagues, among sports, because it's all about the Benjamin. There is so much money. It's a $1 billion industry. At the end of the day, they don't care. They're numbers. These guys are property. They're resources. And we all have a little bit of blame to share on this because it's entertainment for us.
Oh, we do, Mel. Completely. You're absolutely right. I'm sitting here and I'm with one hand complaining about the safety issues and the ridiculousness of the NFL. And on the other hand, I'm preparing for my fantasy draft next week.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, you watch the games, and you know, it's become such that I watch the Super Bowl and I watch the occasional game because on the grand stage there is nothing quite like the performances that we see. When you see a guy like Aaron Rodgers throw that ball, I mean, there's just so few people that can do that. But when you see a guy like Calvillo, and I actually met him a few weeks ago, a day after his birthday. I had the honor of meeting him in Baskin-Robbins. He was picking up his own birthday cake. And you look at him, and they become more and more human and personal to you. It's sad. It's horrible. And you know, I think of so many examples. And frankly, what has taken us so long to realize what the true sacrifices are? And when you look at it, especially at the collegiate level throughout the U.S., it's unbelievable how many young guys are just going to sacrifice so much. The examples go on and on. ALS. I'm thinking about Tony Proudfoot.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. You know, these guys, it's more than just names. Tony Proudfoot was a huge, huge personality in Montreal. I never met the guy, but frankly, I had a lot of love for him. And when he went through what he did and he wrote those columns in the Gazette, I read it with one hand, and I have to admit I was holding a Kleenex with the other.
Oh, they were heart-wrenching.
And heart-wrenching, it's just too much. There's no answer, but as for your question, is this a fair amount? There is no amount of money on earth that I personally would accept, and there's no sacrifice that I would make to give up the joys and the pleasures that I take for granted each and every day, hugging my kids, being a part of their lives, and hopefully, with any luck, dying of natural causes at an old age. Because these guys... sleep apnea. Go on and on, man. You could talk about the health, the results. 400-pound linemen, are you kidding me? We're not built to be that size.
Yeah.
And when the sacrifices that these guys make, it's not worth it. Their average lifespan is diminished. And even if they do live a longer life, at what cause? Their brain is turned to mush. They can't breathe. They got to plug themselves into machines. They can barely walk. Jim McMahon is lost. He was once one of the most dynamic characters out there. Right now, the guy can't add. It's beyond belief.
Mel, thank you, man. Thank you so much. Don't be a stranger. That was a great call. And
thank you.
Hit a lot of those points that I agree with. And, you know, he looks to a guy like Jim McMahon. My mind goes back to Lyle Alzado on the cover of Sports Illustrated when I was a little kid, the former L.A. Raider.
Mm-hmm.
Who ended up dying of cancer, and I think it was brain cancer. And that was a long time ago that he straight out said that there is a correlation between my dying and taking steroids.
Yeah. And this was a guy
which allows him to hit harder, which allows him to... it's a vicious cycle, really.
Well, you know, Mel talked about it being a business and how money rules pro sports.
And he's not kidding.
And it feeds itself all the way up the chain. You know, you look at pro football, the players that they develop to play pro football, well, all through college, what percentage of the college players go on to play pro? How many of those kids are cast aside by injury along the way? And some of those injuries are hand injuries.
Don't forget, there's still a lawsuit pending in the NCAA as well. So this is yet to play out. I wish that this had broken a little earlier in the day so we could have gotten ourselves a fancy lawyer to explain it all nice and tidy for us, but we'll do that next week. Let's go to Travis in North Carolina on the Kaufman Show. Hello, Travis.
Hello, Dave.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
Good.
I don't think that's a fair settlement.
You don't think it's a fair settlement?
No, and I don't think one was ever going to be possible, you know, because the effects of it are so massive, and maybe it's genetic. Some people are more predisposed to it than others, but it doesn't take much to get messed up playing football. It really doesn't.
Well, just one hit would do it, right?
The thing is, though, is that practice is worse than actual games because the drills happen so quickly in succession. It happens more often and more concentrated.
That's an interesting point.
I honestly believe that the kids in the United States right now that are currently playing Pop Warner youth football are the last generation to do it in a publicly funded environment.
Which is why you wrote your tweet saying that this is it for football in schools.
It is. And then at that point, in a generation, there may be people willing to pay pro players, but there's no developed talent base.
Well, that would be an interesting way for football to die out.
It would.
And, does it happen, though, in the hotbeds, in Texas?
Is in Arkansas, in Louisiana? Not a chance.
Well, that's the thing. Insurance still exists in Texas. You know, the county high school still has to get liability insurance
mm-hmm.
in Texas. And that's going to be so exorbitantly expensive that unless these parents are willing to spend $2,000 a year on their kids to enroll them in these programs, they're probably going to die out.
Huh. That's a really interesting point.
I played for less than 2 years in middle school. I wasn't good enough to play in high school. And I was a safety. And I had multiple concussions, minor, nothing serious in practice. I know I did. And it didn't affect me at the time. I had one later in life when I was moving, and I dropped something on my head. And I had tangible changes in my personality and how I perceive things. Things felt differently and weird. And this is somebody who didn't play in a high level, never even came close, only had minor impact.
What was the culture like, the response to your injuries at that time?
Yeah, 1998, 1999, it was nothing. You know,
suck
you
it up?
Go and get up. Yeah. No, there was never any concern about it. And at that point, in the late 90s, the major helmet companies and the NFL had more than enough research to realize that there is absolutely no helmet material of any construction type that's going to reduce concussion. It's purely chance-based because it's the rotational stress that causes the damage, not the direct linear impacts that are tested for, the stuff that is designed to impact skull fractures. That's what helmets are designed to prevent.
There are very few ways for football to be played safely. I don't see them starting to play flag football.
No, even that. Hockey has its own problems, but it's possible to play hockey and not have a significant risk of a concussion with every single play you make.
Well, we see it when the women play.
Tackle football. Exactly. It's not the case with tackle football.
No, it's not. Travis, thanks so much for the call, man.
Cheers.
Speak to you soon. This is the Kaufman Show. We're going to take a little break, come back with Torben Rolfsson. We'll laugh before we'll cry, Sean. It'll be fun.
Okay.
All right, cool. Stay tuned. Big man, you're fast on the Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman, special co-host Sean Farrell in studio tonight. That's Vancouver's Japan Droids, the Knights of Wine and Roses. And we might as well stay out in that beautiful city of Vancouver and bring in our next guest. I like to call him the Henny Youngman of the Kaufman Show, which I think he appreciates because he sent me this awesome picture of Henny Youngman and Judd Apatow from what could only be like the Brown Derby in Hollywood. I think that was probably it. Torben Rolfsson, follow him on Twitter at VanGuy. Hello, Torben.
Dave, Sean, how you guys doing?
Great, how are you, man?
Hey, Torben.
It's great. Monsoon season is among us.
That's not a thing I only hear about that on BBC World News.
Yeah.
Doesn't really affect us here, monsoons. You guys don't get monsoons in Vancouver.
Well, how are things there?
Things are well.
It's drier than that.
No monsoon.
So Team Canada finished up their mini camp. Did you see that?
I did. They were playing ball hockey.
That's right. They were putting together the best ball hockey squad in the world. And strong leadership on that team, too. Duncan Keith has emerged as the guy who yells, car and game on.
Nice.
And TSN's Roberto Luongo interview was broken up and stretched over three parts. It was drawn out like Peter Jackson adapting a Tolkien novel. You know, that Luongo interview even had bonus footage that was released. They were that close to issuing the whole thing as a DVD package, but we've already seen the bloopers. And Johnny Manziel, he's going to miss the first half of Texas A&M's opener. It's a noon kickoff against Rice. So will most A&M fans. It's Tim Tebow didn't even get a drive in against Detroit. And I think the only drive he's likely to see at this point is to the airport.
That's probably a good call, or to church.
And why is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie taking verbal shots at a New York Jets reporter? Obama would never do that. He'd send in a drone. Terrell Owens is suing his former agent, Drew Rosenhaus. We need Terrell's spokeswoman to tell us how many reasons he has to sue him. And the, I know you're a big soccer follower, Dave.
Huge.
Champions League group draws came out today. Arsenal's with Marseille, Dortmund, and Napoli in the group of death. And Bayern is with Man City and Victoria Pilsen in the group of beer.
That's good.
ESPN finalized the deal to pay the Little League World Series $60 million over 8 years for broadcast rights. That's a lot of pizza and ice cream.
Wow.
And next, we'll have a controversy over whether the players should be paid.
Not bloody likely, man.
No. And there's a lot of fanfare surrounding Ichiro's 4,000th hit, which includes his Japanese League stats. So we're counting everything now. Doc Ellis, 5,000 hits.
I'm going to stop you there because that was golden, Torben.
Hall of Fame.
Oh, that was fantastic. Torben Ralston, ladies and gentlemen, follow him on Twitter at VanGuy, and stay tuned for more of his shenanigans next week on The Kaufman Show. Thank you, Torben.
Thanks, guys. Have a great evening. Take care.
Cheers.
5,000 hits. Marco's got a sports update for you. That's one thing you could never do on radio.
Pitch a no-hitter on
5,000 hits of LSD. Yeah, that would make for an awfully tough time juggling all these balls that we got in the air right now. Come back after Marco's sports update and pretend that it's 2003. We're going to talk about the Believer Fever Expos. I can't wait to get your phone calls on this station, which used to broadcast those Expos games. Good memories, bad memories, trips down to the stadium, trips to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Anybody out at that rally at St. Hubert Airport? You remember that? After they came home from the crazy road trip and were still standing?
Right.
Dozens of fans made it out there. There were probably a good 200 fans.
Boy, it was something.
Yeah. Remember Kevin Barnes? Montreal baseball fan who was in this studio? He organized that rally. Okay. He was the one who coined the phrase Believer Fever. Oh. We're going to have some fun tonight on The Kaufman Show. I hope you all stay tuned. Isn't that just the cheesiest song ever, eh?
It may be the cheesiest song ever, Dave, but I tell you, it was music to your ears when you're going walking into Gerry Park. You knew there was a ball game, a National League ball game being played in Montreal that day. It was awesome.
Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. That was the Montreal Expos theme song. The other voice you hear in this room is former Associated Press beat writer for the Montreal Expos, Sean Farrell. Sean now works for the CP, but we're going to concentrate on 10 years ago. Sean was mentioning before that he covered the last five seasons of the Montreal Expos?
Last seven.
Last seven, okay.
Five of them I thought would be the last one.
Oh, it's nice to laugh, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It's funny because it's true.
That's right. That's right. Now, of course, of those 7 years, the 1 year where there was any kind of excitement about the team making a playoff run was that year.
Yeah,
it was 2003.
That was something. August of that year was really unbelievable. And, you know, this was a team on death's doorstep as a franchise in Montreal. And they just put together something really magical that month.
I remember being in such shock at the start of the season, well before August. First of all, like you said, that there even was a season. Because after 2002, there was a real possibility that the team was going to be contracted. Not moved at that point, but contracted. And I remember thinking, going to that last game in the 2002 season, which was the game where Guerrero, correct me if I'm wrong, but where Guerrero
was going for
40-40, exactly.
Yeah, we debated whether that ball went over the wall or
that
not.
Was, I think
would
that
have been
was,
its 40th home run.
Which was actually, I believe, the second to last game of the season. And
yes,
then the
I
last game
right.
of the year, Frank Robinson batted Guerrero first. He ended up, I think, having six at-bats. Like, they gave him every chance to try and hit that home run, and he didn't. But
so what did it go down? Is it a double off the top of the wall? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was the phantom double, which would have been a home run now with the rules for instant replay having changed, which I always thought was interesting. I would love to see him retroactively get that. But the point of the story is I really thought that was going to be the last baseball game I would ever attend. And it would have been an okay way to go out, watching Ken Griffey and the Reds play the Expos. But we got another year out of it. We ended up getting another two. But at the time, we knew we were getting another year out of it. And my goodness, end of April, they were still in it. End of May, they were still in it. Gets to June, people start getting excited. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that more people started showing up, but it felt that way. They were louder.
Yeah.
They were more into it.
Have we touched on Puerto Rico yet, Dave?
No.
That's an important element here.
It is. It is, of course. The Montreal Expos played 22 of their 81 home games that year in San Juan, Puerto Rico. You weren't there, were you, Sean?
No, I didn't go to Puerto Rico, okay. But they played their home opener. I think it was April 22nd. How many games were they into the season at that point?
Many.
They had already done their first trip to Puerto
Rico. Hiram
Bithorn
Stadium, yes.
Yeah.
Which included some wonderful radio moments, if I may say so.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I can remember Roberto Clemente Jr.
That's right.
In the box with Elliott Price, talking about something being simple or something being easy, and him saying, well, it's as easy as shooting monkeys in a barrel.
Okay.
Which, the things that stick with you over time.
Sure.
Exactly. San Juan was a tough one for fans, because it was the admission of the ownership of the Expos, which at the time was Major League Baseball, that it wasn't working, it wasn't going to work, and they had to find additional revenue streams somewhere. This led to a road trip in the month of June that had the Expos, and again, they were home games because they were the team that batted last, but the home games, they were living out of a hotel, out of a suitcase, in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I think that was the biggest thing, the fact that they were on the road. And these were sandwiched in between road trips.
Right. So it was a 26-day or 26-game, 28-day road trip that had the team bounce from San Juan to Seattle. Any union worth their damn would have fought against that, but there was nothing to do. They ended up shutting the players up by giving them a bit of money. I don't know if you remember that, Sean, but there was a time where the players held a no, you're not doing this. And I think they each got something very nominal in the end. Maybe not nominal to the fringe guys, but nominal to the big guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, that one road trip really sticks with me. I remember a three-game set in Oakland, a three-game set in Seattle, and they had to fly across the country. We had Zach Day on the show a couple of years ago, and he was telling us about he had never been a part of a road trip where the plane had to refuel. And I think that just said it all.
I'm looking at the dates here, and they played a Sunday afternoon game against Texas in Puerto Rico. Guess what the time of that game, the elapsed time on that game was, Dave?
How long?
Getaway day from from Puerto Rico to Seattle, 2 hours and 19 minutes.
Oh, really? That must be the widest strike. The strike's almost the size of the Caribbean.
But and then course, they played the Tuesday night. They played in Seattle. That began a road trip, a three-game set in Seattle, three games in Oakland. Finished off. They didn't come home after Oakland. They went to Pittsburgh.
They went to Pittsburgh. My 22-year-old self that summer was a traveling salesman for a textile company, and this allowed me to be in the car and drive around all day listening to this radio station and fall deeply in love with those Expos. Mm-hmm. And every night at 7 o'clock, I was at the stadium. I think I went to 55 of the 59 ball games, something crazy like that that year. I'll never forget that season. That, to me, it resonates more than 94. I was a little kid summer of 94. I was 13. It was cool to have the best team in baseball when you were 13, but...
But that was your pennant race.
That was my pennant race when I was I guess I was 22. And I'll never forget how exciting it was. I lived for baseball that summer.
It must have been a tough, very tough September.
It was a beyond tough.
Yeah.
Beyond tough. And you know, I'm going to read you guys something. I wrote this a couple of years ago. I ended up appearing on Getting Blanked, very renowned baseball website in this country. I'm thinking back fondly to where I was 8 years ago this week. Believer fever had held her grip through most of the summer, and after taking the first three games of four-game set against the Phillies, the Expos and their fans knew that the math was simple. Win the last game of the series and were tied for the wild card heading into September. At the time, there were no hard and fast guarantees that the team would be in Montreal the following season, so it was our final kick at the proverbial can. While it would be a stretch to say that the city was behind the team, there was an excitement among many Montrealers who realized that this would probably be the last pennant race we'd ever be involved in, at least one with any kind of intimacy. Omar Minaya had gone out and acquired veteran Todd Zeal. Not quite like getting Cliff Floyd or Bartolo Colon, but it showed the fans that the fever had crept into the front office as well. It's kind of funny how excited we were at landing the 38-year-old Zeal. If anything, it shows how abused we were as fans. But he was the most legit third baseman to play for us since Tim Wallach. We did our best to overlook the fact that Zeal was at his best when Wallach was playing. 8 years ago this week, I was at the Stad in seats above the dugout tunnel for the fourth game of that series. A Thursday afternoon game. Javi Vasquez and Amori Telemaco. The walk-up crowd that day was huge. A shade over 20,000 people were there, most arriving well after the Wilkerson single, Cabrera RBI double, and Guerrero homer that gave the Expos a 3-0 lead after the first inning. They never looked back. Vasquez dominated the slumping Phillies for 8 innings, striking out 10. A 4-0 win, a 4-way tie with the Cards, the Astros, and the Marlins that the Expos would face at Joe Robbie Stadium in their next game. Fans went wild, myself included. A 4-way tie for second best had never felt so good. We all know the rest. Rocky Biddle walks in the winning run the next night in Miami. The season goes down the drain. The Expos weren't allowed any September call-ups. Actually, not true. And finished a mile back of the Marlins for the wild card. Marlins went on to beat Barry and the Giants, Bartman and the Cubs, and Rocket Roger and the Yankees to give Jeffrey Loria that 2003 World Series ring that he so desperately craved. But ring the bells, there would be a 2004 season for the Montreal Expos. And that was, you know, every year around this time, I really go back to that moment because it felt so good.
Mm-hmm.
And for so many years of feeling so bad, being an Expos fan, that was a reward all on its own.
Those pennant races are what you lived for when you had a baseball team. You were emotionally invested in that team. And we talked about it a little off air, Dave. My pennant races began in 1973. The Expos found themselves in a 5-way race for the East Division title. It was insane. And the Expos, 5 years in as an expansion team, were actually contending for the division.
At Jerry Park.
At Jerry Park. There was a picture in the Gazette of a worker rinsing off the Cincinnati Reds on deck circle with the, you know, what if.
How old were you then?
I was 9 years old. It was unbelievable.
So you were... in your mid to late teens then for 79, 80, and 81.
Oh, I was what a team. Looking back on that team, it's unbelievable that all they have to show for it, and in fact, all the franchise had to show for it when it left Montreal, was the 1981 East Division title. You know, that's all the Expos ever won. But you know what? They won that, and anybody that lived through that knows the excitement of the heart. You talk about heart-wrenching, heart-rending.
That game five.
Everybody talks about it. And it's funny because I heard somebody talk recently about Steve Rogers.
Well, yeah, because he was just in town, right?
Right, and how Steve Rogers, people still come up to him and ask him about that pitch. And you know, when I think of Steve Rogers, I think of the Expos ace. I mean, he really is up there in the category of the two Martinezes, Pedro and Dennis. He was money. He was the guy you wanted on the mound. And he took out Steve Carlton twice in the playoff against the Phillies.
That's right.
He was unbelievable. And he pitched a one-hitter, I think it was, against the Mets the day before they clinched the second half title. I mean, he was...
He didn't get his due. He doesn't get his due in this town.
Well, you know, if you're going to hang it on that one pitch, I mean, the guy came in, he was the man, you know, somebody needed to step in there. Reardon wasn't available because of his back.
Right.
He came in amped up, he got a ball up, and Rick Monday can hit home runs, you know. It's baseball. It's going to break your heart. Tell that to a Boston Red Sox fan. Tell that to a Chicago Cubs fan.
When I interviewed Rogers, I stayed away from that question. There's too much to talk to him about to be the millionth person to ask him about one pitch.
He was so much more than that. Oh. It was so much more than that one pitch.
You know, numbers that I didn't know were possible. Nobody's thrown 300 innings in my Montreal Expos lifetime. I never saw that.
Yeah.
It's incredible the guy's arm didn't fall off.
Yeah, different age, eh?
Totally different age.
Complete games. He was a complete game shutout that could happen. And you know, remember Pedro in 97. I know guys who covered the team that season, and they just loved those nights because...
Well, you knew one. Yeah, you knew 20% of the time you were going to watch Pedro pitch. Yeah. I could see how that would be a joy. I wanted to ask you, Sean, about the difference between being a fan in a pennant race and being a journalist covering a pennant race.
When it's your team, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's something that you deal with. I mean, you've been covering Montreal sports, and you're a Montrealer, so the Alouettes are your team, the Impact is your team, the Habs are your team. But I feel like there's a special spot for you for the Expos.
Sure. And I guess it's personal for any journalist, but really, if you got to cover both sides of the story, if you've got to cover it objectively, you really do have to remove yourself from the outcome. You know, from rooting, having a rooting interest in that respect. We may have rooting interest for deadlines, but it certainly makes you see the game in a different way. You know, you and I talked a bit about a game during the 2003 season.
Well, let's talk about that game because it's one of my favorite games. I can really come back to three games from that season that were, and we'll talk about all three of those games.
Sure.
But let's talk about I guess it was the sixth game of the year out of seven games against the San Francisco Giants.
Yeah, that's right. And the Expos had won the first five. They were on an incredible roll at home. But Sidney Ponson had just been acquired from the
Baltimore.
Orioles.
Yeah.
And he was pitching lights out for the Giants. And I think he had a three-hitter going through, carried that into the ninth with a 2-0 lead. You know, I mean, it just looked like, okay, you know, here's the end of the streak. And he gave up a hit. I think he gave up a couple of walks. There was an out in there. So he came out of the game with the bases loaded, but still 2-0. Handed over to, I'm trying to remember now if it's Todd or Tim.
Interesting. I think it was Todd Worrell.
Yeah, the closer for the Giants at the time.
And if it was Tim, Todd can sue us. That's cool.
My apologies. Mm-hmm. And then did he get an out? However it came about, it came down to Brad Wilkerson at the plate.
Mm-hmm.
The bases loaded. The Giants leading 2-0. I think they, you know, still given up four hits in the game to that point. And Wilkerson worked into a full count.
And at this point, Sean has 695 of his 700 words written for a 2-0 Giants victory.
It's a 2-0 shutout, a great pitching performance by Ponson. Real, you know, closes it out, end of the streak.
Right, Sir Sidney cools off Expos. I can see the headline now.
Yeah, and you know, there's also the element of all the excitement that had been built up in Montreal. You know, if they lose this game, well, that's not, you know, you kind of pushing that down.
It kills that momentum. Yeah.
But then what happened next? Brad Wilkerson hits a grand slam over the center field wall. And you as a fan,
I was dancing on the dugout. The place went wild. And, you know, I don't have very many memories of the Big O going wild with 40,000 people. There's a couple. I remember Cordero's hit in 92.
Mm-hmm. Against the Phillies.
Down the line against the Phillies. Yeah. That was a big one. That might have been the craziest I'd ever seen the
insane.
Big O.
You could feel that.
But for 15 or 20,000 people, never. You never would have believed hearing that crowd that it was such a small crowd.
You heard the crowd a lot better than I did in that moment, because at that moment I was trying to tell a story that had just been completely rewritten before my eyes, and trying to get in the element of you know, the excitement of the crowd, and that's obvious because they've won by a grand slam in the ninth.
It was an afternoon game, though. It's not like you were on deadline.
Well,
right?
I'm on deadline because my story's got to get out immediately for the wire service.
Okay,
so, yeah, it's not a newspaper deadline. So, and yeah, I turned that one around pretty fast. That was. You're a bit disassociated from what's happening. You're reporting it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as a fan deep down inside, that's...
Those are the moments you live for, man.
Yeah, so I miss out on that as the fan misses out on that in the moment. And you find yourself looking back at it after the fact going, wow, that must have been something. Hmm. Really.
And it really was. I mean, it has stayed with me for a very long time and will continue to. There's nothing like that feeling of having, and this is why, you know, I was asked before what team I cheer for.
Yeah.
Connor asked me earlier.
Yeah.
I like Tampa Bay.
Yep.
I don't hate Toronto, Montreal, but I don't. But I don't feel the same lows. Frankly, I don't feel the same highs.
Yeah.
It's just watching a ball game.
Emotionally invested is the right term, right?
Well, or I'm not.
What you're missing is that.
They're
that investment.
They're
that,
mine.
That it matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It
Absolutely.
Was my team.
Yeah.
And it's as much as I love baseball, and I think I love the game more now than I did then, because I watch a lot more of it. I don't just watch the Expos. I watch baseball now.
Mm-hmm.
But not with the same emotional attachment, that's for sure.
Yeah, agreed. I've wrestled with that one, Dave. I wish that I was more interested in some teams.
Let's hear some Anakin. Then Marco's got a sports update. Then we'll come back. We'll speak with Max Harris and former third base coach Manny Acta. It's an Expos full. Expos heavy. Happy? Can we do this happy, Sean?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. We're going to keep doing this happy. No crying today on the Expos. On the Expos. On the Expos postgame show on Team 990.
Is the anthem played. Now my homemade sign's got his autographed name on the newspaper cover, first rush with fame. I remember singing Valderraw, 03 wild card race, last hurrah. I remember Vlad 40-40 in the call they got wrong. The game against the Braves, Cliff Floyd going long. Still missing Montreal ball 6 years on. Yeah, sometimes you don't know what you got till it's gone. One's for Brick, Larry, Walk, and The Rock. And this one's for El Presidente, Moe, and O'Cab. And this one's for Spaceman, Crow, and Vlad. And most of all, this one's for us, the fans who stuck with the team when the times are tough. Singing.
Those were the days, and the memories will never fade. Those I'm holding by.
I remember Rondell White.
and Lou Frazier, Odie Nixon, FP, Eli, and Laser. I remember the magic, El Perfecto, 27 men up then down like Presto. I remember sun coming down on the field, no roof. I remember doing a jig on the dugout with youths. I remember just how close we came, 81 in the Sprite year, still feel the pain. I'll never forget that last night at the O, had both arms wrapped around my dad and my bro. It looked just like that pic we took years ago. The only thing different were the tears that flow. Yeah, most of y'all must think I love the Habs war, but if it were up to me, I'd feel like 94. I remember the last time I checked the box score and the last sad send-off from Dave Van Horn. This one's for the kid and the cat and the hawk, and this one's for Grit, Larry, Walk, and the Rock, and this one's for El Presidente, Moe, and O'Cab, and this one's for Spaceman, Crow, and Vlad, and most of all, this one's for us, the fans who stuck with the team when the times are tough, singing.
Welcome back. It's the Kaufman Show on TSN 690. I'm Dave Kaufman, joined in studio tonight by special co-host Sean Farrell. We're talking Expos, and we're going to be joined by Max Harris in a few minutes. But first, I just want to shift gears. Got some really good news last night. Watched, came home a little late and turned on the U.S. Open, watched James Blake bow out and retire. An incredible career. Great, when he was in his prime, a really fun tennis player to watch. And that was on TSN. Flipped over to TSN2, and my stars, Keith Olbermann's show was on.
I saw you tweeting about that.
Man, I was so happy.
Yeah.
I was so happy. There has been nothing but positive press about what Olbermann's been doing with his new show. And I really didn't think we were going to be privy to it up here in our igloos in Canada. So he did something last night, and I'd like to play it for you. He was talking about yesterday, of course, was the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, which we have discussed on our show. We had Sharon Robinson on about a year and a half ago, Jackie Robinson's daughter, talking about being at the March on Washington and fainting from the heat. Very interesting interview on our archives if you want to find it at thekaufmanshow.podbean.com. But in the meantime, without any further ado, this was Keith Olbermann last night honoring his father, Satchel Paige, and Dr. Martin Luther King.
You know what the real connection between Dr. King's speech and sports is? Let me tell you, today reminded me of another day that I was talking about Dr. King with my late father, and he brought sports into it in a way that I would never have expected, and he revealed something that was to him 66 years after the fact, still personally painful and mortifying in a way I could never have imagined. He was in the hospital then. He spent 7 months in surgical ICU, and he was never more noble than when he was there, and we were talking about Martin Luther King. You can't really remember what this country was like before integration, he said. He was right. I remember the protests of the mid and the late 60s. I remember the night Dr. King was shot. That aspect of the world before then, kind of just a bad dream. My father paused. You know, I saw Satchel Paige pitch. I assumed he had changed the subject. I had had no idea he'd seen Satchel Paige pitch. As far as he'd told me, he'd stopped being a baseball fan in 1948. Just as Satchel Paige finally came to the major leagues. This was before he was in the majors, my father explained. I saw him pitch for the New York Black Yankees at Yankee Stadium during the war. What year would that have been, Keith? 42, 43? I told him it was 1941. The year I turned 12, he said. I think I went to several games. He was phenomenal. He was everything they said. And you know, not once did I wonder, why wasn't he pitching for the white Yankees? I had black friends, I had Jewish friends, I had Catholic friends, I went to school with them. There was no prejudice where we lived in the Bronx. There really wasn't. It was great. He continued, but as I think back on it, not once did I wonder why Satchel Paige wasn't pitching for the white Yankees. Only years later, he said, did it dawn on me that what I thought was the reason, that maybe I had been told was the reason, was a terrible, terrible lie. My dad teared up, And I mean, he didn't tear up in that hospital when they came and drew his blood every hour on the hour. "Keith, I swear to you," he said, "it never occurred to me, it never occurred to anybody I knew, that he couldn't play for the other Yankees. We just assumed he didn't want to, that none of them wanted to. I thought blacks and whites both wanted to be separate," he said. "I was old enough to go to Yankee Stadium by myself, and I was still naive enough to believe that Satchel Paige wanted to pitch for the black Yankees instead." Amazing. He kept shaking his head. I asked him when that changed, when he realized all that was a lie. "Well," he said, "first with Jackie Robinson. But even then, it didn't really hit home. Just how it had poisoned everything. Poisoned everything. Poisoned it beyond our ability to even realize it had been poisoned. It didn't hit home," he said, "until I saw what they did to Martin Luther King and the other protesters. And that's why segregation survived so long," my dad said. "Not just because there was racism, but because there were people who were not racist and still didn't ask. Why are people kept apart because of color? The same people who never asked, why isn't Satchel Paige pitching for the white Yankees? Or never asked, why aren't there any black people living in this neighborhood out here in the suburbs?" My dad looked at me and said, "Getting people to ask that, that's what Martin Luther King did for this country and for me." And my dad smiled.
You're listening to The Kaufman Show. We'll be right back with Max Harris. Welcome back to The Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman and Sean Farrell here with you. I hope you enjoyed that little interlude from our Expos talk, but I thought it was important to get it out there. And, yeah, once again, Olbermann on every night on TSN2. Great news if you like your sports highlights done right. And that's just a small example of the quality programming that you can get from that very liberal left-leaning man.
Oh, I look forward to seeing Olbermann's show while he's back in sports.
We'd send this one out to Edward Snowden, but it would be too obvious. So let's just bring in our next guest. He is a good friend of mine, now based out in San Francisco. He's the voice of the USF Dons, works for the Giants, worked for the Raiders, ABC, I believe. There's a lot going on in Max Harris's world. You follow him on Twitter at MaxTheGuru, guaranteed sports thoughts sprinkled with frequent Simpsons, Seinfeld, and Wire references, and some Mad Men, I guess, once that gets back going. Max, how are you, my friend?
Doing great, Dave. It's good to speak to you.
Always, always. What's going on, man?
Well, as you know, Dave, yesterday coincided with the 10th anniversary of Believer Fever, which I know you guys are talking about.
Yes, sir.
The Expos knocked off the Phillies 4 straight to get themselves in a 4-way tie for the top wildcard spot in the National League.
Yep.
And while the Expo Nation movement has been so forward-thinking and progressive and forward-looking over this past summer, and that's really wonderful news, I think it's also important that we do take a step back to...
To what? I need closure on that anecdote.
He's giving us a cliffhanger.
What just happened? Oh, my goodness. What on earth was he going to finish with there? I don't even know.
Mm.
That we should...
You're at a loss.
We need closure on that anecdote. If I don't know what I'll do if Max Harris isn't back on the line in 3, 2, 1. Max Harris.
I'll try this again.
All right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's important to take a step back to remember how important baseball can be, even for a short period of time, how much joy it can bring us, because I think that's what the memories you really need to have in the back of your head as you or us as Expos fans go forward in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
I think that's a very fair point. What I find interesting going to events like the pitch and catch rally that was held a couple of weeks ago, Max, so many parents brought their kids. And kids, they have no clue what this feels like. They've never been through it.
No, and that's a great point. And by the same token, the older fans gravitate to 81 to 94, good or bad. I had neither of those. So for me, 03 really stands out as the one time in my life where I genuinely believed that this could be the year for the Expos. I mean, one of the great things about baseball is that it sort of allows you to believe in spite of all available evidence. And no, I mean, let's be honest here. I was very confident. I had supreme belief in an Expos team, and that's something that had never happened until that season.
Not to mention, not just an Expos team, but like an Expos team with Jose Macias and TJ Tucker. And
okay, and Vladimir Guerrero and Jose Vidro and Levon Hernandez. I mean, there were some guys who could play on that team, Dave.
Trust me, I was there, I know, but, you know,
we believed,
and the, you know, that belief didn't disappear when Vladimir Guerrero went out with an injury.
No, that's right. People forget that. Vlad went down, and really the Philly series is when he really started to come back. I mean, Vladdy had 3 home runs in that series, and, of course, then being his last season with the Expos, he had that cycle game at the end of the year, but, you know, definitely an incredible 4 days of baseball. I mean, you think about that Thursday afternoon game.
Yep.
You look at the box score, it says, what, 20,000 in attendance. I know that doesn't sound a lot if you're listening from San Francisco or for Toronto or for anyone else, but 20,000 all walk up pretty much for a day Expos game, almost unprecedented at that time. Unheard of, really.
Sure. You saw people lining up through the fourth and fifth innings to get into the stadium because they had closed all but one or two of the ticket booths because nobody was expecting it.
Yeah, they were just not even equipped to deal with the kind of walk-up they had that day. And, of course, you look at that schedule going forward, the Expos only had 6 games in Montreal in the entire month of September.
Man, that's not fair. But, I mean, there were X amount of home games, quote-unquote, in San Juan as well, right?
Right. That's why I said 6 games played in Montreal.
Right.
The Expos played another 6 home games in San Juan, although they did actually finish their final, I believe, 9 games on the road, which, again, is a little weird in the season as well. They sort of have it very condensed, not getting to Montreal till April 20th and then leaving a week and a half before the season ends. That's sort of unusual.
Yeah, well, that cuts off. I mean, the baseball season is, what, 27 weeks long, 28 weeks long?
Yeah, they're about, I mean, 6 months, so thereabouts, about 26, 27 weeks. And, yeah, I mean, you think about the kind of momentum that could have happened hypothetically if all of a sudden the Expos get back with those 6 games and they're still in it. The kind of enthusiasm that was slowly starting to simmer and mount. I mean, I remember listening to this very radio station that Friday morning. The anticipation, the excitement of the callers, just giddy for the Florida series and how relatively short-lived that was in retrospect.
Yeah, it was a day.
It was a day. I mean, the Expos lost Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday to the Marlins. And then if that wasn't enough, they then lost Tuesday and Wednesday in Philadelphia. So, you know, but very short-lived, and of course, also unique because of the fact that these games weren't on television.
That's right. That's right. They were not on TV. And that brings back, you know what, that brings back a whole other set of memories of sitting with a friend of mine watching MLB at bat and hitting refresh on the computer and refresh on the computer and refresh on the computer so that a little dot would move or tell me if it was a strike or a ball or an out.
Right.
Man.
That's the funny thing. I mean, you know me, Dave. I'm 23 years old. We're not talking about 1968 here. We're talking about 2003.
Yeah, you know what? Even 1968, we could be talking about the 20s right now. I watched this wonderful documentary over the weekend that had a whole part about it with a broadcaster doing recreation of games from spring training games because there was such a mad demand for it in New York City that even though the games weren't televised, this guy would do a recreation and would win the ratings.
Right, and then you have the polar opposite of that as Expos fans of, I mean, you know, I loved Elliott. He did a great job, but the fact that well into the 21st century, those are your only options to consume the game, you know, that's difficult. And granted, I sat by my radio diligently every single night listening to Elliott and incredibly grateful for that, but, you know, it does pose another set of realities because there was so much opportunity with this team that had they been able to break through. That had they just to get to a wild card. I know people poo-poo a wild card. The Marlins won the wild card in 03.
That's
right. Won the World Series. And you could say the same about the Angels in 02 and the Red Sox in 04. Now, I'm not saying the Expos in 03 would have won the World Series. That's insane to say that, but no, it is. But, you know, you get a chance, you get excitement, and maybe, just maybe, things would have been different. So that's why I really gravitate towards the Believer Fever series more than anything else.
Do you have other specific highlights from the season, Max?
Well, I think one that gets lost in the shuffle, I mean, I'm glad you pointed out the Wilkerson walk-off grand slam, full count, bases loaded to dead center. I mean, that was cliche. Wilkerson also had the natural cycle against the Pirates.
Wasn't that on St. Jean-Baptiste Day?
It was on St. Jean-Baptiste, one of five ever in Major League Baseball. And, of course, he wasn't even the only Expo to cycle that year, as Vladdy hit one in September.
That's right. Huh. That afternoon, it was a St. Jean-Baptiste, an afternoon game against the Pirates, if memory serves.
Yes, it was.
And I remember driving home afterwards and listening to the highlights on Team 990. Mm-hmm. Back then, Elliott and Mitch Melnick were doing the home games, and Wilkerson hit a single, and Mitch said something to the effect of, well, he's just a double, triple, and homer away from the cycle now.
Exactly what happened, of course.
There's another game that that comes to mind for me, Max, and I imagine you'll remember it, too, because it was the night before season ticket holder day.
Okay.
It was a Braves game. Do you remember that in July?
Oh, was that that was the walk-off wild pitch, wasn't it?
That was the, among other things, it was an incredible comeback. Michael Barrett home run, exactly.
Yes.
And then Ron Callaway hitting a ball over Andrew Jones's head, which never happened.
Never happened.
Never happens. It happened, just to be clear. But
it didn't happen in 2003 very often.
Exactly. Probably the best defensive center fielder in baseball at the time.
Which, again, if you're under the age of 15 and you're listening, once upon a time, Andrew Jones was the greatest center fielder ever. It seems hard to believe now, but I'm telling you, he was.
It's true. Nobody would ever buy that if they just showed up off, you know, from under a rock right now. Really, Andrew Jones? Come on. You're kidding.
I can remember Andrew Jones ending a game against the Expos at Olympic Stadium, diving flat out in center field, running away from the running towards the fence, diving flat out to catch it for the final out. He was absolutely
Fun to watch.
Sensational. Yeah, he was a great center fielder.
Knock that Braves team for all you want, for all those Brave teams over the years that were so hard to watch because they won so bloody much. They were great teams to watch, though.
You know, that series, that four-game series against the Braves at the end of July was really electric. I think they split the series. You had that game that you're talking about. But the whole series itself was just something that really led well into August for the Expos at home. You know,
Expos went on to
sweep the Giants, a four-game series. And as we talked about before, that was a season sweep.
Right, which had never happened. Had not happened
San
to the Giants.
San Francisco and New York Giants had never done it for more than an interleague three-game series, I think.
I think the last time it had happened, John McGraw was managing the New York Giants at the Polo Grounds.
Warming up with Christy Mathewson out there.
Mel Ott.
Well, that's right. And, of course, that Saturday night game against the Braves, I believe, if it was not that game, it was the week after, would also have been the year that Gary Carter would have gotten the Hall of Fame.
That's right.
The last time that he would have been at an Expos game. So
that was the following week. It was a game against the Brewers. The Brewers were in town.
In fact, that's a great memory.
I forgot about that.
But Carter was inducted that weekend
into
the Hall of Fame.
And it was put on the board.
That was recognized at some point during the game.
That is absolutely correct. And another great memory from that season. It was fun. It was fun. And for so many years, people were told what a miserable fan experience it was to go down to the stadium. And that year was the blip. It was the one year where you could have a good time. Go down, and chances are you were going to watch the home team win a ball game.
And the amazing thing is it happened against all odds. This was the first Puerto Rico year. You know, everything was stacked up. I mean, Max said it before, playing their home opener on April 22nd.
Yeah.
You know, they were 19 games into the season when they played their first game at Olympic Stadium. But to make something like that happen under those circumstances.
Well, the contrast between 03 and 04, where, you know, everything that could have gone right up until September 1st went right in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong from April 1st to October 1st in 04.
Yeah. kind of hurt not to have Vladimir on the lineup.
Yeah, well, and the team came back from, you know, another super extended road trip to start the season, mm-hmm. and they were already out of it.
Yeah.
Hard to get a fan base behind you when you play your first 3 weeks on the road and yeah. only win a third of the games.
That, I think, actually is one of the things that played into it in 2003 was the way they came into Montreal when they played that first game. They were, looking at it now, they were 11-8, but they had won the last two games against the Reds in Puerto Rico. You know, I think that when you say believer fever, might have the seed might have
been planted right then. Back, absolutely, yeah. Sure. To come home from that trip, three games over 500, and I mean, I don't know if this is just, you know, weird memories or not accurate, but for me, the team always had a bad April. It was very rare that that team wasn't out of it by the end of April. So
and
that
the
was
exploded yeah. out of the gate that year, Dave.
That's right. That's right. They did. And again, you know, maybe it's not fair to say because of Vidro and Cabrera and Guerrero, but it felt like a team of nobodies. It felt like a team that didn't have a chance, battled against the odds all year, were key underdogs. And, you know, one more thing I want to bring up with you, Max, before we let you go, because we got Manny Acta coming up in about 5 minutes' time.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the push to trade for Juan Gonzalez?
Yes.
That was something that was very
now
interesting.
I
remember Omar Minaya, after Guerrero went out with his injury, and they thought he'd be out, what, four to six weeks.
Yeah.
Omar Minaya flew down to Texas to try and convince Juan Gonzalez to sign with the team. In
right,
vain.
To waive his no-trade clause.
And that's one of those,
happen.
You know, that's a revisionist history, the what-ifs. That would have been a very interesting move. Much more exciting than Todd Zeal.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's one that I forgot about that until you had mentioned it. But even at the time, there was so much ridicule from the national media of this will delight all 8 Expos fans and all that. And you see so many Expos hats in Quebec right now. It's almost become in style or cool.
Sure.
In 03 or 04, when we had a team, you almost never saw it. It was very uncool in many ways. So,
oh, no. It was all Yankees hats back then.
Yes, because the Red Sox hadn't even won yet, so it would have been all Yankee hats.
Oh, Max, it's been fun talking Expos with you.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. Always a pleasure.
Anytime. I'd say let's do this next year on the 04 retrospective, the non-believer fever. But we'll find many more opportunities between now and then to talk some good times and some baseball. I want to thank you for sharing your memories with us, Max. And I encourage all of you out there that use Twitter to follow Max on it, at MaxTheGuru. Quite a fun follow. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure, guys. Take care.
Take care, Max.
There he goes. Mr. Max Harris. We'll be back on the Kauffman Show. We've got Manny Acta, former big league manager, former Expos third base coach. And we've got that bet going, Farrell. I don't mention it. I don't mention anything about food, okay? I bet you he's going to say something about smoked meat.
Okay, fair enough.
Just throwing it out there.
All right.
It's the Kauffman Show on TSN 690. Welcome back to the Kauffman Show. Dave Kauffman and Sean Farrell in studio. I know Sean's really excited to speak to our next guest. It's been a couple of years, eh, Sean?
I can't wait.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to wait too long. He's on the line. So without any further ado, let's welcome former Montreal Expos third base coach, former major league manager, and current friend of our show and our station and our city, Manny Acta. Hello, sir.
How are you guys?
We're great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. If you hear any weird noise, it's because I'm watching a minor league game right now.
Where are you?
I'm in Dunedin, Florida, watching the Toronto Blue Jays A-ball team. I have a nephew that plays for them, so I just decided to come over and watch them play.
That was the team that Vladimir Guerrero played on for a couple of games last year.
Yes, indeed.
It was brief, but it was fun to see him with that uniform on, that's for sure. And there's one of those weird sounds. There you go. Manny, I wanted to ask you, we want to talk about the 03 season. Can you believe that, first of all, 10 years ago this week was that Philly series?
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about that and how great he was, and I just can't get out of my head that series that we played in Montreal against the Phillies, and we swept them over there with about 25,000 people at the Olympic Stadium, and you know that's the loudest stadium I ever been around because people were banging on the seats and all that, and you know we played a tremendous series coming back from a couple of big leads that they had, and then we went on the road and everything just went away, and it was just one of those magical seasons that just went away in 1 month.
It was the season was 1 month too long, is really how it felt from this side. But it was a team that had battled so much adversity. And I know you've been on teams that have battled before. You've been on teams that, I think back to 06 when you were with the Mets. Like, that was a really good team. That was a strong team. That team made the playoffs. That team came within one at bat, arguably, of making the World Series. This was a special team as well, though, was it not?
Yeah, it was. It was a special team because we had to deal with so much. Mainly because we had no ownership. Major League Baseball was running the Expos, and there was already that black cloud on top of us that we were going to leave Montreal. We didn't know where we were going. Whether that same season was when they decided they weren't going to contract the team. Actually, the year before, but we had no clue what was going to happen. And as you remember, we started playing games in Puerto Rico in 2003, and so we had to deal with a lot of stuff, mostly mental stuff. And then at the end, it became physical, too, because playing that schedule, those scheduled games in Puerto Rico, the traveling became a pain at the end and actually took a toll on a lot of the guys.
Do you remember the trip in June, Manny, when it was from, Zach Day we had on the show a couple of years ago, and Zach talked about how that was the first time in his career that on a road trip, the plane had to stop to refuel because it had to go from San Juan to Seattle.
To Seattle. That was unbelievable. And it was something that, I think guys weren't able to recuperate from it. And it was just a long trip just to stop to refuel. And then you had to, go again for a few more hours. So it was something that, only we could put up with. And I really think it took a toll on the guys, not only physically but mentally, because a lot of them started thinking about the wrong things. Why do we have to be going through this? Does anybody really care about us and this and that? And, at the end of the day, we just couldn't get it done on the field.
And yet, Manny, you did continue to get it done for another couple of months.
Yeah, we did after that. We bonded as a club. We had a lot of guys that have been together for a lot of years through the minor leagues and the Expos. And then, they knew the situation we were in. So they kind of took that underdog type of attitude and really helped us out up until that last month when we just ran out of gas and we couldn't get any help because of our economic situation and just ended up costing us.
It makes Puerto Rico almost a double-edged sword in the sense that it may have bonded you guys, but ultimately it really did take a physical toll and a mental toll on the team.
It did, without a doubt. I think, the fans already were bummed out over there in Montreal because they were feeling that the ball club was leaving and, they weren't, they were bitter and sad, and they were supportive when they could, especially on those series when we were, giving those guys a fight. But at the end of the day, they knew we were leaving and they felt like they were betrayed and all that, those kind of bad feelings. And it was just bad. It was just bad all the way around, not having the security of knowing whether you were going to stay, whether you were going to go, and the economic situation too, because not having an owner really takes a toll on everybody.
And yet you guys still made something magical happen. I think of that series that you played against the Braves, the four-game series in late July, that was kind of the start of something special at home, at Olympic Stadium in Montreal for that team.
Yeah, it was. I believe in a couple of those games we were trailing by 5 or 7 runs, mm-hmm. and we made a couple of comebacks, and especially against a team that used to just own us, the Atlanta Braves, with that pitching staff and that offense that they used to have. But You know, we were just we were playing terrific baseball. It was a blast seeing, you know, Vladimir Guerrero on an everyday basis when he was on top of his game, and just seeing one of the best double play combination on Vidro and Cabrera going at it, and some of those scrappers that we had, like Brad Wilkerson and Andy Chavez and some of those guys, Schneider and Michael Barrett. It was a fun team. We also had some good pitchers, some young guys that were just, getting their feet wet, but also a couple of veterans like Javi Vasquez and Joey Eichen that really kept the team loose, but also, you know, help us out.
It was a young team, and for lack of a better word, it was an old manager. Frank Robinson was in his late 60s at the time. I would imagine that a lot of the job of keeping that clubhouse pumped and keeping that clubhouse intact fell on your shoulders.
Well, it did in a way, because I have to be very thankful for Frank Robinson, because when I joined his staff, it was my first year in 2002, and he gave me a lot of responsibility, and since we had a lot of Spanish-speaking players, you know, I was kind of the liaison in between the coaching staff and those guys. And it was interesting, but, you know, the second year on 2003, he was, you know, much better. He let those guys be themselves, and they ran their own clubhouse, and we just ran whatever went on the field, and, you know, we got the best out of those guys.
Yet it was such a successful season in 03 compared to in 04.
Yeah, I think, you know, the 04, it was just, you know, a really sad season because, you know, Vladdy was gone. We had to play without our big horse, and it was pretty much a goodbye type of year. It was just a very sentimental type of thing, and a couple of the guys knew they weren't going to be there. Some of the guys even turned down contract extensions because they were still not, you know, not a good sense of where they're going to end up playing the rest of their career. So it was just a goodbye, sad, I wouldn't say go through the motion type of year, but I would say that a lot of the guys were just trying to find out what was next for them.
And for all of that sadness in 04, there was so much hope and optimism in 2003. And I think and I hope that that's what a lot of Expos fans can cling on to when they think about getting a team down the road.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I think one of the saddest thing out of the whole thing is that everybody loves Montreal. And every one of our players loved it. They felt safe, which was the biggest thing for us. And, you know, Montreal as a whole different ball game. It's just a different culture, and it's beautiful. It's different than every city that you go through, and everybody liked it. And the players coming in from the other ball club also liked it. And it was just too bad that didn't happen. I hope that someday baseball comes back to Montreal. I know it's not an easy task, but I do think it's a wonderful baseball city, and they proved that before we got over there when they had those wonderful teams under Philippe Galou.
When's the last time you were in Montreal, Manny?
I was on that last game. I haven't been able to get back because, you know, my job obviously hadn't allowed me to. And I do have a lot of good friends over there, on Mr. Albert Saragossi, who was a season ticket holder, and Max, Mr. Guru, who was a little kid when I was over there. It's a grown-up now.
He sure has. And,
yeah, Andre Thibodeau and some of those guys, and that I used to hang out over there and continue to keep in touch and see those guys here in the States whenever they come over here. And some of the guys that I used to work with over there, I keep in touch, you know, with Claude Ramon and Danny Boucher once in a while. You know, we bump into each other.
Manny, what's Montreal's legacy like around baseball? You've been in the game since, how do people perceive what happened in Montreal, and is there a void in baseball without a team here?
Well, I tell you what, the new generation of players probably are not as attached as the veteran guys, because they weren't witness to it, but the veteran players and most of the coaches have been through it, and managers, you know, really miss it because it was a special place, and it was just a sad ending of a baseball franchise that was there for so long and brought baseball so many great moments, and it was just a sad episode in baseball.
Well, luckily we've done a lot to try and combat that sadness, and there have been some trips to Toronto where last month there were over 1,000 Expos fans at a game in Toronto. We had a pitch and catch rally at Jerry Park a couple of weeks ago where 250 Expos fans showed up, including Claude Raymond and Denis Boucher, and Steve Rogers was there as well. And I'll tell you, Manny, it's been 9 years now since you've set foot in our city. And we've got to get you up here and take part in one of these Expos Nation events, because it can't be a decade between times that Manny Acta comes to Montreal.
I would love to get back. I mean, I'm working on that with my best friends from over there. It's just that right now I'm tied up with two jobs, and the winter is coming, and I would love to go over there during the summertime, obviously. And I'm working on it because it's always going to be a special place to me, and I would always consider my favorite city in the world. It just, you can't beat being safe and eating as good as you can eat in Montreal.
Follow him on Twitter at MannyActa14. You can keep track of all the stuff he does. He contributes to ESPN. He's the GM of the Lycée Tigers and the Dominican League. And Manny, we always wish you nothing but the greatest of successes, and we miss you.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot for having me on your show.
Anytime. Thanks, Manny.
All right.
There he goes. Former third base coach Manny Acta on The Kauffman Show.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break in two? I didn't think so. You ever try with all your heart and soul to get your lover back to you? I don't hope so.
You don't knock, don't knock, just walk on in. The door. Walk on in.
Wrapping it up here on The Kauffman Show, and it's been a really fun one. Sean, it's been great to have you here, man.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, Dave, and we're trying to stir up those happy memories of the Expos.
It's tough.
That's what it's about in the end, though, is the things that draw you to it.
You looked over at me right as the song started and said, you miss writing baseball.
Yeah, there's, you know, going to a baseball game, there's always the chance that you're going to see something that hasn't happened before. You know, that's really unique. When you cover a lot of hockey games, the left wing lock and the neutral zone trap and fourth line grinders, you know, there's something magic, I think, about baseball. The timelessness of it, the fact that you can be down 11 runs and still win a game down to your last swing. It's not likely going to happen.
Well, no, and as a baseball writer, you're really not hoping for that.
Not as a writer. That, I guess, is the fan in the back of you, but... yeah, you're not rooting for that as a writer, that's for sure.
It's
but
it's,
you know what? You know what, Dave? Actually, yeah. in a funny way, you are rooting for that as a writer in the sense
well, it tests your metal, right?
It tests your metal, and what I loved about doing it was I got to be the guy that told the story. You know, and looking back on these some of these games 10 years later with you this week, I've been able to reread what I wrote, and it's nice. It's nice to see that that's what I saw, what I reported at the time, and some of the details are really really striking to me.
And they bring back such wonderful memories. It's cool that they're there. They are, I'm sure it's not something that you think about at the time, and especially not when you're pumping out as many as you are with the frequency that you do. I mean, you could do a story on last night's Alouettes game, and I doubt that 10 years from now you'll come back and say, oh, I remember those days.
although last week's Alouettes game.
No, I'm sorry. It was a great, you know what? It was a terrible game, and they came back and they won, and good for them. But it will not, at least not for me. It will not, an impact game. You know, great. They won 5-0 against Houston. Did you write that game story?
Yeah.
Do you think you'll remember it?
Maybe. Just in the sense that they're five goals scored. But yeah.
But I think you get my
something
point.
About, yeah, absolutely. That it's just what's woven into the story of a baseball game that can make it so unique and well, so memorable.
Long before we became friends, you were the guy telling me that story. And it's cool to have you on my side now. But I knew you then, and I know you now, and I like both of you.
Thanks, Dave.
And I appreciate all that you did to help bring those games come to life for us fans. It was good.
Thanks a lot.
It was good, and you should be very proud of the work that you did.
It
brought a lot of people there and probably made a lot more people go to games.
Well, that's really cool to think of that. And it was a great experience, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Thank you for coming in tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks to Marco Polo on the board, and our thanks to Max Harris. Follow him on Twitter at MaxTheGuru. Sean is at SeanFarrell27. Everybody with, and Manny Acta 14, you guys in your numbers.
Yeah, yeah, that's the Ron Hextall in me, the goalie swinging the stick.
Yes, and Manny's, I'm sure, is for Plex, right? thanks to all our guests and callers and tweeters and all of you for listening. This is TSN 690. You've been listening to The Kaufman Show. We'll be back next Monday at 6 p.m. Try and keep track of that one.
Listen up, kid. It's not what you think. Stayed out too late. Had a little too much to drink. Walk home across the bridge when the marquee shut down. There's a reason that I love this town. Nobody cares how much money you have. If you've got enough to get in a cab, there'll be drinks on the house. If your house burns down, there's a reason that I love this town. I saw your band in the early days. We all understand why you moved away. We'll hold a grudge anyway. I shot the shit with miniature Tim. If he needs a tune, then I'll write one for him. We like the same books and we like the same sounds. There's a reason that I love this town. I played a show in Kelowna last year. Said, pick it up, Joel. We're dying in here. Picture one hand clapping, then picture half that sound. There's a reason that I hate that town. You saw my band in the early days, then you understand why we moved away. Will you hold a grudge anyway? Because it's
face down in our suit, some French restaurant. I saw Riviere de Loup last night at a tour. We burnt the place to the ground. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town.
You've been listening to The Kaufman Show on TSN 690. We'll be back next week.
I don't know.